This is the Lubetkin on Communications podcast for Wednesday, April 11th, 2018. Hello and welcome to the Lubetkin on Communications podcast. I'm your podcast host, Steve Lubetkin. I am Podcast Steve on Twitter. And in the course of my communications consultancy, we produce podcasts for corporate clients and other organizations. We also produce video and audio programs. And among these is the Lubetkin on Communications podcast, in which we present interesting interviews with people working in the communications and journalism fields. And from time to time, we present recordings of programs and seminar panels that might be of interest to our listeners. In this program, we present a recording of the April 5th, 2018 Meet the Media panel produced by the Public Relations Society of America's New Jersey chapter in cooperation with the Public Relations Student Society of America at Rutgers, the Rutgers chapter, and the New Jersey chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists. The panel included Ivy Charmetz, the executive producer for News and Special Projects at News 12 New Jersey, Charlie Cradiville, the editor of New Brunswick Today, Jackie Lieberman, the franchise owner and managing editor of TapIntoWestfield.net, Michael Days, the editor for readership engagement at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and Howard Burns, editor of NJ Biz. I was also a panelist in my capacity as the New Jersey, Pennsylvania editor for GlobeStreet.com, the commercial real estate news website that I report for. Moderating the panel was Ken Hunter, APR, Director of Marketing and Communications for the NAFA Fleet Management Association. We'll go to the lectern where Ken will introduce the panel.
Our panel will cover a variety of topics. We'll be having Q&A at the end of the panel. If you do have anything that's incredibly timely you would like to bring up, please feel free during one of the panelists' remarks. If you have a follow-up question you'd like to ask, you're free to do that. When we get to the speed pitching portion at about 9:30, you'll have 60 seconds or less, one-on-one, to directly talk with your panelists, to get feedback, advice. Also, a no is more than acceptable, panelists, so keep that in mind. And for those of you that are students as well, that are interested in networking or even want to try to practice a pitch, you're welcome to talk with our panelists at the end. Introducing our panelists, I'll start down at the far end. Steve Lubetkin, who's also our podcaster for the day, who just had guests do some emergency setup to be able to get some of the audio. He is the New Jersey, Pennsylvania editor for GlobeStreet.com, where he covers the commercial real estate sector in the region. Also, he's a news anchor for the daily New Jersey radio-style newscasts on the Radio Jersey Show on AsburyMusic.com. That's 6 to 8 p.m. Mondays through Fridays. Next to him is Charlie Cradiville. He is co-founder and editor of New Brunswick Today, which is a bilingual community newspaper that's been covering Middlesex County since 2011. He's also a Rutgers grad, so welcome back. And also, he had launched Patterson Press earlier, which was a hyper-local news project in Patterson during his time working for the Citizens Campaign. Next to him is Ivy Charmetz. She's executive producer of News and Special Projects for News 12 New Jersey. She's an Emmy Award-winning executive producer for News and Special Projects. She first joined the station in 1996 and oversees the station's production of specials, including the very popular On the Road series, and also a Rutgers graduate. And she's also an experienced PR pro with an emphasis on message identification and development. And she received the Gracie Award for her story on Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member Darlene Love. So welcome. Next to her, Jackie Lieberman. She's the franchise owner and managing editor of TapIntoWestfield.net, which is an online news site serving the town of Westfield, New Jersey. We'll talk in a second about what the business model is for Tap Into, which is an interesting one. She covers anything that is of interest and importance to people living or working in Westfield. That includes government elections, education, police and fire, human interest, etc. She's not a Rutgers grad, but a Drake University grad. Next to Jackie is Ken Schlager, who is editor of New Jersey Monthly. Prior to joining the magazine in 2008, Ken was executive editor of Billboard, the music business newsweekly. He also served as an associate features editor of the New York Post and as a reporter and editor of Gannett Westchester newspapers and the Fort Lauderdale News. He's a University of Missouri Columbia grad and lives in Montclair. Then next to him, Howard Burns, who's editor of NJ Biz. He has 34 years in journalism as a reporter and editor, working both B2B and B2C spaces for dailies, weeklies, and quarterlies. He's been the editor since November and worked in senior editorial and reporting positions at the Pittsburgh Business Times, 18 years at the Hollywood Reporter, the Miami News, and Multi-Channel News, and he's a University of Miami grad. Probably loving our nice hot weather today.
Oh, yes.
Next to him is John Enslin, who's the multimedia reporter for The Record and also NorthJersey.com. His motto is, have video / audio, will travel. He produces a podcast called On the Record, and prior to that, he covered the state legislature, Bergen County government, politics, and Patterson. He's also the president of our co-host today, the New Jersey chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, and he previously was the national president for that, so he's slowly working his way down the food chain. Then lastly, next to me is Michael Days. He's editor of partnership engagement at the Philadelphia Media Network, which incorporates the Philadelphia Inquirer, Philadelphia Daily News, and the newspaper's joint web portal, philly.com. Prior to that, he'd been editor of the Philadelphia Daily News for 10 years. He was at the helm when the paper won a Pulitzer Prize for investigative reporting in 2010. He's also served as a managing editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer, worked at the Wall Street Journal, the Louisville Courier Journal, and the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle. He's on the national board of the Associated Press Media Editors, has served as a juror for the Pulitzer Prizes, so I'm sure everybody on our panel is going to want to network a little bit later today. And last August was inducted into the National Association of Black Journalists Hall of Fame. So thank you to all of our speakers. We did have one cancellation due to breaking news. Julio Cortez, who is the staff photographer for Associated Press and the Newark Bureau. We'll jump around with questions, and not every panelist needs to answer every question. I'll be directing the question the first time to a particular panelist, but other panelists are welcome to hop in if they have something additional they'd like to add. So first, and I'll stick with Michael here for this question. Over the past year, how have you been seeing your newsrooms change since you have two newspapers, the website? Have you seen a fair amount of, you know, either staff shrinkage, tighter reins on budgets, sections being scaled back or even eliminated? Any other trends that you've experienced? And please pass the microphone down.
Well, that's actually an easy one for me. We've blown up the place probably for 80 years or more longer. There was the Inquirer newsroom, the Daily News newsroom, and the Philly.com the last, since internet, the last 15, 20 years. There's one newsroom now. There's one set of editors. Every person in that room had to apply for a new job. We were geographically based in terms of what our coverage here, Philadelphia, South Jersey, Pennsylvania suburbs. Now we focus more on issues as opposed to covering South Jersey. We have people covering modern life, and if, when I say modern life, I'm talking about millennials. What we found was when we decided we had to really move quickly from print, which people think it's dying. I don't think it's dying. I think, you know, it'll be around for a bit, but the world has shifted to these things to get their news, right? So when we realized we had to focus on digital, we had to be much more focused on what do the readers really want? What do they really care about? And who's reading us online? And what we found was the audience was mostly older, male, and white. And in a region that is diversifying very quickly, that's not a recipe for success. Back to your initial point, how are we changing? We really are focusing a lot on who's reading what, how long are they online. If you get somebody reading a story for 3 minutes, that's a big, you know, happy dance in the newsroom, because that's considered a very long time. We still worry about print, and I still focus in the afternoon on, you know, what's going to be on the cover of the Daily News, but it's really very much digitally focused. And I would say to all of you, if you really want to know who's covering what, go to philly.com/staff, and it'll be a breakdown of every staff writer, what they do, what they spend time on. It's been a dramatic change, and it's still ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Any other panelists seen a dramatic shift in the past year in your newsrooms?
Yeah, we blew up our newsroom too. First off, we had an ownership change. The paper became a Gannett paper, and the focus changed very much from the print product to the digital side. There's a lot more concern about numbers and what kind of engagement we're having. The goal is to not only get people to the site, but to make them stay, make them want to stay. So that's one of the things that's altered. Plus, there's been a culture shift. Many of my colleagues have learned within the last year how to shoot and edit a video. And for myself, I've been engaged in collecting and editing audio.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'll throw this question over to Jackie first to tap into Westfield, and also maybe by way of explaining what the TAP business model is that will help answer this. What sorts of tasks and duties and other needs have really been added to your plate over the past year? Are you handling both advertising, journalism, what the, you know, images, et cetera, will look like on your site, having to share pieces with other TAPs? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's actually been our model from the beginning, Well, first of all, I'm an independent. I'm an independent owner, but I'm part of a network. So we share across sites. Something happens in Westfield, and the town next door is Scotch Plains. They want to run it. They can run it. And we work together that way. One thing that has been changing really over the last year is we're adding a lot more video, and we've added podcasts. So we're really using that multimedia platform that we have available to us. And Westfield's one of the first towns to do that. TAP is now in more than 70 towns. We're all over New Jersey, but we're also in upstate New York, and we're in Parkland, Florida. And that is our first Florida site, and we're going to have more there soon. Mm-hmm. What else?
And are you also responsible for selling advertising?
Yes.
On your site as well?
Yes. So I'm the publisher. I'm the managing editor. I sell most of the ads. It's very small operation. We have pretty much no overhead, except for the IT that's required to keep the site running. Mm-hmm. So I don't have an office. I don't have a staff. I do have freelancers who work for me. So I'm not alone. But it's a very small operation.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and also for TAP, what would you consider being your biggest competition when it comes to hunting for news?
I don't really have any. the thing about TAP that's really unique is that we're hyper-local. So we cover only what is very important to people in our town and not what's important to people outside of our town. There is a print newspaper in my town. We don't compete the same way. They're a weekly. They're print only. You can get them online, but you have to wait for that day and you get the PDF. So usually by the time I've had a story for a week, they finally have it. There's really not a lot of people doing exactly what I do. It's very niche.
Mm-hmm. Right. And that's a good lead-in for the next question, which I'll throw over to Steve first. Wake up, good morning. Have media outlets really been relying a lot more on outside stringers, contributors, you know, possibly as cost-saving measures? And if so, since there are, you know, two places where you work essentially in that kind of capacity,
sure,
is that something that's going to be a continuing trend across newsrooms?
Oh, I think so. I don't see the numbers that a lot of the other newsrooms have, but the organizations that I'm working with, Globe Street, for example, I'm one of about half a dozen editors around the country managing regional pages on a freelance basis. We get paid on a by the story. We have a story allocation for those pages, and there are a couple of full-time editors in New York and California, but the vast majority of the site is maintained by freelance people. So that's, I think, you know, unfortunately for most people doing journalism, the full-time jobs are going to shrink and shrink and continue to shrink.
For any of the other panelists, are you seeing a trend of engaging more freelancers for coverage rather than adding staff?
Well, I'll take it. In the business journal world, we have, and all business journals, no matter who owns them, they have what they call spotlight sections or focus sections, or a section that zeroes in on a particular sector in a given week. Now, that's an advertising-driven section, even though it's not advertorial. So to do those 52 weeks a year, you have to farm those out to freelancers, because you cannot ask your regular staffers to do daily, weekly, and, oh, by the way, you have to do these focus sections as well. It's just too much to ask at this point. So we do farm out these special sections that zero in on a particular industry, and you know, I'm sure that my publisher would prefer that I didn't do that, but it's just too much for the regular staff to maintain themselves.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to pose this question first to Ivy at News 12. With the constant rush to quickly post breaking news, what's the process you take to ensure content is accurate versus just a rumor versus just, well, a one person said this kind of thing? Because also the other panelists, it used to be the domain of TV and radio to be first to market with whatever the news is. But now with the internet, everybody here faces that same challenge. Do I run with this first, or do I check it out a little bit deeper? What's your process for vetting that?
We still use the traditional two-source rule. We confirm it with two sources before we go with it. We have had times in the newsroom where we see another station tweet something that we don't have. It happens very rarely. You know, we won't have that, and then we'll kind of rush to try to confirm that ourselves. So we're sort of struggling with the idea of having to be fast and first and new and millennial and, you know, all of these things, while at the same time still trying to be journalists, you know, as they say, with a capital J. So it's kind of like this fine line that we walk, but we're trying to, you know, still be right, not just first.
Mm-hmm. Any of the other panelists have particular policies or issues aimed at that question, so that you don't, well, accidentally have to do oops or correction?
Accidentally, right. New Jersey Monthly, we have a small editorial staff. It's 8 full-time people in editorial, including myself, and 2 people in the art department. 2 of those 8 people are fact checkers. So that's how committed we are 25% of our staff time is committed to fact-checking. Most, going back to the previous question, most of what we run comes from freelancers with that size staff. So we're, and we try to, you know, we try to use the best people we can. We pay them well. I think we probably pay freelancers better than anybody in New Jersey, and by far. And we also, by the way, all of our photography is freelance. So because we're relying on outside people, we really put a heavy emphasis on fact-checking. That's for the magazine. I will tell you that for the web, most of what's on our website comes from the magazine, but we do have a fair amount of original content and a growing amount of original content. And that, for the most part, is not fact-checked. If we have something that's, you know, we don't do news, but sometimes we do things that are approaching kind of spot news, those we'll fact-check. Because we don't want the oops moment. But most of what's original to the website is in the form of blogs, a lot of dining coverage, style coverage, and that stuff we feel is a little less sensitive, so we won't fact check it. We will go back and change things on occasion. But we're very proud of the fact that in print, we there are always going to be corrections, but we print very, very few corrections because we're just so meticulous about it.
This question I will send over to Charlie first. I've always been curious because the comment sections are the Wild West, but can be very entertaining or very infuriating, depending on your viewpoint for a particular article or other commenters' viewpoints. First of all, do you read those religiously? And do you also read other media outlets' comments as ways to potentially find new angles or stories?
So, no, I don't religiously read the comments, but I do often read other coverage comments to find new angles. That's absolutely a good way to find things that the journalist may have missed or just might be potential other stories. So there's just too many to read them all. And in fact, we get way more comments on social media than we do on the articles themselves. But I do, you know, read them from time to time and sometimes learn things. But also sometimes it's frustrating to see reactions that are from people who quite clearly have not read the article. So don't let it get to you.
How many of our panelists regularly read the comments following any of your particular pieces or other reporters' pieces at your outlet? How many? And social media as well.
More social media.
More social media.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We don't allow comments on our site. We allow them on our Facebook page, but not on our site.
Mm-hmm. And why is that? What's the rationale behind that?
Too often with comment sections, you get what we call trolls. So they're people who are just trying to get a reaction, and it really takes away from the piece. We want people to read the piece on its own, and then they can go to the Facebook page and have a discussion about it. People are a little bit better on Facebook, but I still keep an eye on that Facebook page to keep the trolls off so that we have a real discussion about the piece.
Mm-hmm. Well, and which kind of leads into another question, which I'll give this to John at the Record first. For your annual reviews, how are journalists measured nowadays? Are you looking, or is it the quantity of people that read an article? Is it the feedback that they get? Is it just purely knowing it's a job well done? What sorts of things go into those evaluations for reporters?
It's funny because I just turned mine in the other day.
And you walk on water, correct?
Well, so far. I'm still standing. Before I answer that question, though, can I say one thing?
Go ahead.
You know, I checked in with my editor, Rick Green, and told him I was going to be here today. And he said, fine, but do me one favor. Tell the folks in the audience, and this is Rick Green speaking now, meet us where we live now. If you're pitching ideas, if you're pitching stories, if you have something, think about the way it looks, the way it sounds, what it looks like on video. We are not focused as much as we were once upon a time on the print product. We are spending as much time, if not more, on the digital side and on video and on audio. And I think it's incumbent on the public relations professionals to, and many of you have, to follow suit, because that's where we live now. But to answer your question, Howard, Ken, we're not judged on metrics, per se. I mean, when I fill out my evaluation, it's like, well, what enterprise things have you come up with this year? What new things are you doing to engage readers? Tell me what you're doing to directly meet those readers where they live. But it's not a mechanical, you know, you have so many clicks and you have to get more. It's still based on human behavior, and it's still based on goals and aspirations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any other of our panelists have, I guess, any non-traditional ways that have started to creep into performance reviews?
Our talent is now graded in addition to what they do on air and their storytelling and all of the traditional things that they've been doing. Now they also need to post a certain amount on social media, which has to lead to a certain amount of clickbacks to our website. And that's something that is taking a little bit of time to get everyone used to. And figuring out what works in terms of, you know, upping engagement and, you know, how to do what depending on, you know, whether you're on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. But it all counts now as in terms of whether or not you are a successful, you know, anchor or reporter.
Yeah, I would just echo that as well. I mean, I do quite a bit of recruiting now and sort of bringing people to the table for the editors to take a look at. And if you don't have significant digital skills, you're immediately off the table. Now, the folks in this room, the young people, they're sort of they have those skills sort of naturally because they've grown up on the internet. But part of doing your job now is there a video involved? Is there an audio? Are you posting this stuff on social media? And we were in a Twitter love feast for a long while. Now we've gone to Facebook because there more people tend to go to your site from Facebook than Twitter, unless you're in sports. Sports still and Twitter still have a love affair going. But I mean, you're talking about what was the traditional. What was traditional is no longer traditional. What is traditional now is, do you have a whole range of skills that you can bring to the table?
On the evaluation side, we get a weekly report from the Adobe Marketing Cloud because we're primarily web-based, and this report can be really scary because they measure the metrics of each individual geographic page excruciatingly detailed with, you know, green arrows pointing up and red arrows pointing down. And boy, when you get that report and you see a lot of red arrows pointing down, you're like, what? Why is that happening? And a lot of it is the transition of people reading on traditional web devices like computers and laptops to reading on their phones, because you see the web traffic go down, but the mobile traffic go way up on a week-to-week basis. But they track the clicks on stories. They track individual unique views of stories. They track how many people register on the site. So if they are using a login to come to the site and then register for updates on individual stories, they actually rank the stories by that and by the number of visits. So we get all that information. We don't get graded on that, but they are aware of it. It's, you know, you can manage what you can measure. So they measure a lot. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, I would echo what John said about people thinking in terms of audio and video and photography. More and more, I like to integrate audio and video into my reporting on a regular basis. And if people have audio available that they can deliver, it can save a lot of time in putting together the story. If I have audio from the executives who are being quoted instead of just a text news release, so I would encourage people to think in those terms.
Mm-hmm. And for those panelists that do have video components, do you accept outside video? If a public relations firm gave you an interview, B-roll, whatever, is it something you would use? All right, wait, can I see a show of hands for yes, we would use it?
Well,
sort of. Okay, a show of hands for we absolutely would not touch it, no matter if it was gold.
We're actually trying to get and have been successful at getting people to pay, advertisers to pay to have to produce videos to run as ads on our site. We've done some videos editorially. We don't particularly like it. We don't find they get much traffic. They take a lot of effort. Anytime somebody tells me, a consultant or whatever, says it's easy, I know that it's not easy. Everything takes time and effort. Everything takes resources. And we've found very little return from video when we've tried it in terms of traffic. And when the traffic is low, you can't sell ads against it. So we really are not that interested in editorial video. Occasionally, if something falls in my lap, we'll use it. But otherwise, it's actually something we want people to pay to put their advertising messages in a video on our site.
I would echo what Ken just said. Native advertising is where it's going, where it is, whether you like that or not. And native advertising, for those of you who don't know, is you write a story for your client or for your company or whatever, but it's clearly delineated as paid advertorial as opposed to something that we on our staff have written. And that goes for video, that goes for editorial, doesn't matter what it is. And that's really where it's at now. I mean, at NJBiz, when I came in, they would eagerly take stories or advice or how-to types of editorial from people at companies and run them. And that was great. But the way the business works now, you're going to have to pay for that. We're a business just like you're a business. And we have to find new ways to monetize our business if we're going to stay afloat. Same thing goes with our monthly panel sessions that we do. We do panels just like this every month. The panelists, companies, pay for their people to be on the panel. It's pay to play. Mm-hmm. And whether or not that's something that appeals to a broad range of companies, we're still finding that out. But we do get, you know, we do get good quality panelists who want to get their message out. But that's really where it's at right now, native advertising or pay to play.
We don't just post up anybody's video willy-nilly. I mean, we vet it. But look, this is how news comes to us frequently now. A suspect got pulled over the other day after a police chase and got out of the car and started singing the tune to Cops. You know, Bad Boys, Bad Boys. It went viral. Cynthia Nixon decided to run for governor of New York. She didn't go to the Statue of Liberty and have a press conference. She posted a video. It became part of the news. That's the coin of the realm now. Particularly in breaking news, where in the old days I would knock on doors and ask if anybody got a picture of the fire. Well, now you are searching, and there are actually sites that have this, you're searching for a social media post in that specific neighborhood where you can perhaps find somebody who shot footage of the fire. And that's how you do it.
There's also been a trend of some reporters using what people are saying in Twitter or how Twitter has erupted, etc. Can you really trust something posted by SparklePony23 as if it's just as important as if the governor made a statement?
I'd like to weigh in because this is a pet peeve of mine. I hate it whenever I see a headline that says the Twitterverse is responding. Because the Twitterverse is not a person. The Twitterverse is not accountable. The Twitterverse doesn't have an address. The Twitterverse doesn't stand behind what it says. It's just jabber. And, you know, look, if we find somebody we know is identifiable and real, and not, you know, Sparkle Pony 2, whatever, will incorporate their tweets in the story, but not before we figure out who that is and how they relate.
Mm-hmm. And that leads us into the topic of bias in coverage, of which I'm sure everybody on this panel, plus everybody in the audience, has a particular viewpoint on that. With lots of accusations of bias, you know, media being ranked very low in trustworthiness, having media outlets that are on one side or the other, and gleefully so, how do you try to screen that out in your coverage, or do you view an element of, I'd like to embrace it, so that we can be provocative and be read, be listened to, be viewed? And I'll open that up for anybody on the panel. Go ahead, Charlie.
Yeah, I appreciate the chance to address this. It obviously comes up all the time, especially when you're dealing with PR professionals, advertisers. You might have an advertiser who, let's just say they're a salon or a restaurant, and a crime happens at that place. You have to now decide how you're going to cover, or if you're going to cover that crime that may affect your advertiser in a negative way. So it comes up all the time in situations you can't predict, sometimes in situations that are a little more predictable. If you're covering politics and you have strong feelings about whether it's local or national politics, that could, you know, show through in your reporting. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the way I view it is that as a hyper-local outlet, we are here to share the truth with the people of our community. And so that means that, you know, we're going to shine a light on issues that matter to the community. So, for instance, covering New Brunswick, it's a city with a lot of immigrants. So we're going to cover issues that affect those people. And our coverage might be different than a place that doesn't have such a large population of immigrants. Our coverage may seem like we're pro-immigrant because we're an immigrant community, an immigrant town. Our coverage might seem like we're pro-education because we're home to the State University of New Jersey, and that's our people that we're covering the news for. But I think the most important thing is when you're able to determine that you might have a bias or a conflict of interest, that you do what you can to disclose it. So that means that, you know, for instance, we've got a Board of Education election coming up in New Brunswick. I'm the editor of the newspaper, but I'm also supporting two of the candidates that are running. So anytime we write about the Board of Education between now and April 17th, the article has an editor's note at the bottom that says, you know, the author of this article is a supporter or is a volunteer on the campaign of Jad Kato and Nancy Love, because I don't want people to accuse me of trying to disguise that and mislead them with the coverage. I want them to know, first and foremost, I am supporting these two candidates, but I'm also telling you the truth about what's going on at the Board of Education. So I think it's very important that folks who have a conflict, have a potential bias, be upfront about it. There's nothing wrong with it. We all have various things that, you know, if you're a good reporter, you have lots of friends, you have family members that might be involved in your town, you have strong feelings about certain subjects, and don't hide it, just be upfront about it.
Yeah, I got to take issue with what Charlie just said. and I love Charlie, and New Jersey Monthly has done a story about Charlie, one of the very few journalists, maybe the only journalist that I can think of that we've done a story about in the last 10 years. But I got to tell you, a journalist has no business working for a political candidate. That's the longtime standard. Maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I mean, I know guys, people on the New York Times, their standard is you cannot work, you cannot contribute, you cannot sign a petition for a candidate, you cannot wear a button or a bumper sticker for a candidate. I believe that's the way it should be, and I think you should change your practices on that.
I just wanted to broaden it a little bit. I think we find ourselves in a time now where there are facts, and then there are alternate facts. And I hear from readers all the time who say, this column, this story, this whatever is biased. And then when you get into a conversation, it's biased from their point of view because they don't believe that we're telling the truth. So I think we all have to sort of cling really strongly to making sure, within sidebars or whatever, here are the facts on immigration. Here are the facts on how many people are crossing the border from Mexico in the United States. The reality is it's down. It's as low now as it's been in 40 years. But, some people a lot and readers sometimes feel like, well, you're not really focusing enough on how horrible immigration is. You're not focusing enough on how wonderful the Philadelphia schools are. Well, the reality is they aren't all that wonderful. So I think, are we championing certain things? I wouldn't say that we are, but I do think we're trying to really shine a bright light on issues in our community. And I think that's what we're charged to do.
I'm just going to echo something that Ken said. As a station, we have a very strict policy about being as unbiased as possible. So even I'm not on air. I'm a manager at the station, and I, don't even post anything on my personal Facebook page about politics or anything that could be, could let you know how I feel about something. I agree. That's kind of how journalists, that's how I was brought up. That's how what our station kind of very strongly stands for. That doesn't mean that there are times when we're in an editorial meeting and we all have our own life experiences and things that are important to us where something, may strike a chord. But I think one of the great things about having a diverse newsroom is someone speaks up about something and then, someone else will kind of give you the counterpoint of that. And we try very hard every single day to make sure that the reporting that we do is reporting and not commenting or advocating or doing anything that would be seen as something other than journalism. So that's something that's very important to us. And I think you wanted to respond to something.
I just wanted to say, speak very highly of Ken and his publication. I was the topic of an article, and I will vouch for the fact that they fact-checked the heck out of everything they do, and they did a great job on the piece, and I was very impressed working with everybody from the author to the photographer to the fact-checker. I do respectfully disagree about the, the way this should work. I think that the right thing to do is disclose if you have a bias, but it doesn't disqualify. It doesn't mean you can't cover anything. You could take it too far, I think. Should reporters vote? Should reporters vote in political primaries, right? If you're voting in the Democratic primary, that means you're a Democrat, right? And that's a matter of public record. So should any reporter who wants to vote in the primary not be able to cover government or politics? I would say no. I think that, part of being a good citizen is participating in government and politics. And if you go to government meetings, the first thing that usually happens at every meeting is they ask you to stand and recite the Pledge of Allegiance. And, should a reporter stand and pledge their allegiance to the government of the United States, or does that disqualify them from covering any government in the United States? I say the Pledge of Allegiance because I'm proud to be an American, but I don't think that disqualifies me from covering American government. I don't think voting should disqualify me, and I don't think that volunteering on a political campaign should disqualify me from covering it, but I should be upfront about it, and I am upfront about it.
But I would caution the students in particular that, if you want to make journalism your profession, be careful what you say on your social media platforms. And I'll give you an example. In Pittsburgh, when I was the editor of the Business Times, I was looking to hire an energy reporter. And so I was very interested in this particular woman. She had some good background. She looked like she was a decent candidate. And then I went on her Twitter feed and saw how she was championing a legislator who was very anti-fracking. I hope you all know what fracking is. I don't want to go into a scientific explanation of fracking. But anyway, that's how they extract natural gas from the ground. Anyway, when I saw that, I immediately eliminated her as a candidate. I couldn't possibly, in good conscience, hire this woman to cover energy knowing that she had this anti-fracking bent to her own personal opinion. It was just, she was done at that point. And
at the end of the process, when I told her why she didn't get the job, I explained that to her, and she can use that. She could have used that information however she wanted to, but for me, it was a disqualifier.
The last question before we go into some brief Q&A, and we can just quickly go down the line for this. One of the biggest issues, I'm sure, from your side in dealing with public relations people is you could spend your entire day and night and overnight going through all the pitches, the emails that you're receiving. What's your preferred way for public relations people to reach you or reach your teams, knowing that there are only so many hours in the day? So, Michael, if you'd like to start first.
You know, we've got a good-sized newsroom, and I guess I would say to my public relations colleagues, you know the people covering what. Have some kind of relationship with them. Doesn't have to be a personal relationship, but you know, follow them on Twitter. That's probably best. Follow them on Twitter. Know what they cover. Know what they care about. I can't think of anybody who's going to do a story on a client you have that's having a 20th anniversary. But if they've got a real strong niche in the market, understand when that topic is, whatever the topic is, know when it's hot, when the people are talking about it, whatever the issue is, and then you slide in. I think that's the most important thing. The worst, when I was the editor of the Daily News, and you know, I'd been the business editor for the Daily News at one point, but then we dropped that department, and people would still call and want to talk about business stories. Well, if they had any concept or any knowledge of the paper, they would know that was not our area. So I think, don't waste your time. Don't waste it. People want to know that you're really going to offer them something that's worthwhile.
I would say first line of contact would be email. Don't do the thing that drives us crazy, which is you phone call them to make sure they got the email. We got the email. Don't worry about calling. And think about the step, though, before you send an email. If you know a reporter's covering an industry or a beat that relates to your client, get to know that reporter. I mean, I've had innumerable cups of coffee with people on my beat just to get to know them before the story happens.
I would agree with both gentlemen here. Email for sure. know the reporters who cover those beats, and also know the publication. In the case of mine, which is a B2B publication, know what it is that we cover, know who our audience is, know that we are business to business, so therefore we want to provide actionable information to businesses to help them make money. That's what we're here for. So understand the publication you're pitching to before you make the pitch, and also realize that, you know, papers like mine are very locally focused. So we want to talk to New Jersey people. I don't want stuff from PR firms in Virginia or Baltimore or Los Angeles saying, we have this expert that we want to pitch to you. Well, we have these experts here in New Jersey. I'd much rather talk to them than your expert in Walnut Creek, California.
So. I actually wrote down five do's and don'ts on a little index card. So the first one is of the don'ts is no phone calls echoing what they said, and particularly that phone call, did you get my email? That's really bad form. The second thing is do emails right. Vague subject. The subject line is so important. The subject line is the headline. It's what gets us to open the email. You know, a subject line that just says a pitch. You know, it just doesn't work. And I can't. And you laugh. But you know, I get that all the time. And mostly this is for writers pitching me. But PR people as well. Also, the email should give some clue pretty quickly what's happening. I literally just printed this out. This came to me on April 2nd. This is an email. I don't know how many of you can see it. Okay. So the subject line here is pathways. This is a PR pitch. Is pathways of history. I have no idea what that means. And it has two attachments, the names of which are Pathways of History and Pathways Press. No explanation of what's... I'm not going to open those. I don't have time for that. We're a monthly magazine. If you want to work with us, you've got to understand our cycle. Don't pitch me on something that's happening tomorrow. I'm not interested in groundbreaking ceremonies or ribbon cuttings. We don't do that. You need to know what our publication cycle is. We need like 2 months lead time on stories for the most part. And I'm also not terribly interested in the stuff that's pitched to the whole world. I'm always amused by these emails where people put, you know, you see every journalist's name in the entire state in the two line. I mean, first of all, that's foolish anyway. The names that you send to should always be in the beast in the blind copy. But you know, if I see that everybody's got this, I'm not bothering with it. Okay, so those are the don'ts. The do's are clear subject lines, customize your pitches, understand who we are, understand what we might be looking for. The way you do that is by reading the magazine, or at least reading the website. And also, there's a lot of information for us and probably for everybody else on our website about who we are and what we do. On our website, you know, we have a masthead which defines some of the beats that people have. If you've got a food story to pitch, look for the guy that says dining editor. We have a mission statement. We have a very, very clear writer's guidelines on there that also would work for PR people about the kind of stories we're looking for, what kind of cycle we're on. Pitches that show familiarity with the magazine. If somebody sends me something that says to me, I think this would work great in the garden variety section, that speaks volumes to me because it shows me that somebody knows the magazine and has an idea what might work in our magazine. And also, like I said, awareness of the editorial schedule. Don't tell me about something. I mean, right now we're working on June, okay? And looking ahead to July and August. So we're, you know, it's a very different world from what I think anybody else at this table is in. So there are my do's and don'ts.
Bless you.
So I cover only Westfield News, but I get pitches for all kinds of things. So the first thing I do when I get a pitch from somebody who I don't recognize is I do a search and find for the word Westfield. And if it doesn't pop up, I delete it. And then every time you send me something after that, I'm just going to delete it. So send me only what's relevant to Westfield, New Jersey. And that goes for any of the TAP editors. Send only what's relevant to their town. If you blanket send something to every TAP editor, nothing you send will ever get read again. And the other thing, and this is kind of echo what you said, don't send me something 2 hours before it happens. I don't have a newsroom. I have me. And I really hate telling my son I can't go to a soccer game because I have to go cover a ribbon cutting because someone just told me about something they knew about for a month. So that's my tips.
So we also would like for you to email us, please. But the email you send to us should be different than the email you send to any of these other people up here. So customized emails are the best way to go. Again, no phone calls asking us if we got the email. We did. But I think the idea of the best pitch is not as good as the relationship that you have with the reporter. So following that reporter on Twitter or following, you know, any one of our executive, me, any one of our other executive producers on Twitter, knowing the kind of stuff that we cover and then being able to pitch to us kind of in a conversation like, hey, you know, you might be interested in this. That speaks to me much differently and much more directly than, you know, the tons of emails that we get in our inboxes. And I'm sure I'm not alone when I say we get hundreds and hundreds of emails a day pitching all sorts of things. Some things are good and some things are ridiculous. So to anything that you can do to kind of separate yourself from just being another email that we have to either, you know, open or not, will just benefit you and us, hopefully, too. Show us how doing that story is good for both of us by knowing what we do.
Thank you. So just one tip that I think might benefit some of the folks here, especially if you're at Rutgers. If you haven't already done this, take advantage of the opportunity to be a creator of news. It's one of the you know, upshots of this unfortunate shift in the business is that there's a lot of people looking for freelance reporting, including New Brunswick Today. We give anybody a chance. We do pay people for their work. It's not much, but I think that seeing it from the other side shows you, will inform you in ways that you can't possibly learn by staying on the on only the PR side. I think that that whether it's for the student newspaper or the student radio stations here or for a publication like New Brunswick Today or any of the other publications that are hiring freelance reporters, give it a shot and actually get some experience doing the reporting so that you'll better be able to understand the mind of a reporter and how to pitch a reporter and how to get a reporter interested in your stories. I think that's very useful experience, and especially if you're a college student at this time, you've got a lot of opportunities to do that.
So I would agree with everyone else. Email is the best way to send pitches. No phone calls to ask if we got it, but also don't send emails saying, did you get the email? Because I get those too. Don't make life hard for us. I have the Adobe Creative Suite, but and I know that your executives of your clients like to see the finished news release as a PDF. I can open a PDF and extract the text to do a rewrite on a press release, but send the Word document. Don't make us work for it that hard. In the email, don't say, if you want a photo, let me know. The publications that I work for want photos with every story, so I'm only going to have to go back to you, and if it's 9:30 at night or 2 o'clock in the morning and you're not there, I'm not getting a photo. Put it in a Dropbox folder and share the link. Attach it if it's not too big. If we prefer high-resolution JPEGs, so Dropbox or any of the sharing services are a good thing to do. I also write a computer column for a local Jewish community newspaper. I write about things that would be of interest to an older skewing set of Jewish people who are primarily trying to see the pictures of the grandchildren on Facebook. So don't send me press releases about the newest graphics card that your company has created or the fiber optic cable that you're installing in Newark, because that's probably not going to be a topic for that. So knowing what we write about is important, as well as making life easy for us when you send stuff.
Okay, well, I'd like to give all of our panelists a round of applause. Without you, we wouldn't be able to put this on today.
We hope you enjoyed this program from the Public Relations Society of America's New Jersey chapter. And if you have comments or suggestions about these programs, write to me. You can email Steve at beingthemedia.com. And if you have questions or interest in the PRSA New Jersey chapter, their website is prsanj.org. I'd also like to remind you about my book with Donna Papacosta from Toronto, Canada. It's called The Business of Podcasting, How to Take Your Podcasting Passion from the Personal to the Professional. It's available on the Amazon Kindle and in trade paperback. More information at thebusinessofpodcasting.com. We produce this program in the studios of Professional Podcasts. It's one of our own Lubetkin Media Companies, based here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. We're on the web at beingthemedia.com. For everybody at the PRSA New Jersey chapter and at Professional Podcasts, I'm Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.